call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:35. It's the 24th February, and we do have a quorum at this business to see myself, Senator Boyer, Vice Chairman John Caldwell, and Senator Rita Casillo. We have a few items on the agenda today. The first issue that we're going to bring up is the committee substitute for Senate Bill 123. Senate President Kevin Meyer and Andrew, if you guys are comfortable, we'll all take a motion from Senator Caldwell to adopt it. And then we'll just have you briefly explain to us what issues you addressed in the committee session, and just so that members are aware, we do have Casey Schroeder from law here in the audience, available for questions, Nancy Lee from the court system, Rick Allen with the Office of Public Advocacy, Lieutenant David Hansen with the Troopers, and Sonia Theo from the Municipality of Anchorage.
I move that we adopt for our working document the CS for Senate Bill 123 version on HFS piece that is dated to the H3 system.
Excellent. Is there an objection to that motion? Hearing and seeing none, we have version H before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the District Committee. This is Judy, Senate Bill 123 again, and I'm asking members of some questions, and some of them have resulted in changes to the bill, which is before you, and my trusted staff will go through the CS shortly. I just want to say a couple words. As you know, this bill mirrors the ordinance that was passed in Anchorage last fall. And it says that this would be easier to cite people for Jackson, but I'm trying to get people. The county has, so that it's a deterrent for folks to not touch and play. I think this can be accomplished by reducing the felony, which is currently up to $1 year and $10,000 fine to a violation of a $500 fine. And even though our current law is a state felony, law enforcement, side of our government that's and they're not using it very much because of the investigation process and the length and the cost of the doing such. And even when they do issue charges, very few are actually result in that conviction. So I just want to reiterate this is not intended to be a revenue bill. Like some folks may think it has two zero fiscal notes, and actually, I believe it will result in a savings to the state in the sense that no, we don't have to go through the lengthy investigation process and possibly a jury will be avoided by reducing the penalty from misdemeanor to violations. So, that's it.
Excellent. And not to mention the loss of life, certainly that comes from detention while people are texting. I don't really think this way people's attention, I think. People sort of generally know you're not supposed to do it, but they're not quite clear about what the penalty and the rules are. I think this will be a lot like the primary seatbelt law, which is, of course, going to save many lives. So the committee will bring it forward. Are there questions from members of the committee for Senator Meyer at this point? Okay, excellent. I'm going to let you guys off the hot seat. I'm going to hand over to you. Madam Chair, of whoever Kevin Norman gentleman, I think his name is highlighted the changes as to version H. After our Monday's meeting, I asked for the manager to read one of the questions that you folks had asked, and so in your report in the documentation, I have a lengthy bill answering quite a few of those questions. And what also arose from those questions is that the version that the graphic management landscape would make it cleaner and easier interpretation, like if we cited Title 12 as far as the penalty goes, so that folks are aware that this is actually a violation and not a traffic infraction, which means that you have to close on infractions. So we answered that citation. And then also in my discussions with Nancy and me with the court system, we decided to go ahead and direct the courts to include this violation in the bail schedule. saying that they were also sharing a process for them to be able to discover and do that, and we added an effective date of July 1st to give them a few months to get that accomplished. So those are the changes in the CS. All right, so is there any other questions for Ms. Morgan? Thank you, Ms. Morgan. Okay, and so we do have, as you mentioned before, Nancy Mead and Casey and others with the committee wish to hear minorities, but we're just really happy to open it up again for questions if members wish to hear from anyone else. If you're satisfied, then I would take a motion. Okay, thank you. So the motion before us to move CS for /83/0 this amount and individual recommendations out of the subcommittee committee is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing and seeing that, then you can. So we appreciate all of the time. Thank you for working with the committee to make it just a little bit better than the bill. Thank you. Okay, next up we are senior Summer Barber here in the audience. I appreciate your patience allowing us to get that bill out. So Summer Barber, thank you so much for the room, and you know in our committee it's custom because we're in the standpoint. We're going to go one for a judicial hearing, allow members to take it over and then we can bring it up the second time to do it. So this is your initial hearing. There is a committee substitute version 8 as well that we need a motion to adopt. So let's have that before us as we were talking.
Chair, I know that we adopt the CS for Senate Bill number 24 /18/2716.
Excellent. So, Senator Carter, for the Senate Bill, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for hearing Senate Bill 24. We have brought this bill forward, actually, at the request of the Ethics Committee, who discovered and really pointed out that the way our legislative ethics statutes are written, they apply to contractors. And some of the elements of the statute just don't make sense to contractors and to us. It's just not necessary for example, the folks that print our statute books to attend legislative ethics trainings. That doesn't make any sense. And we don't enforce them. And even if the committee were determined to enforce the statute as it exists, we don't have the staff, manpower, and it just doesn't make sense. So we're just kind of cleaning it up at the request. And it's a housekeeping bill. As far as I'm aware, there's no opposition whatsoever to it. It's just moving its way through. We've changed administrators, and I believe since we started this interview, I'm at a committee administrator, I believe they're both available for questions. And if it's all right with everybody, I'd like to turn it over to my intern, Stephen Sunny, who can go through the bill for you and explain what it's about. And I don't know whether they'll up in another meeting.
Good for you. Thank you. Thanks for having me in the Senate today. This is great. Thank you, Senator Gardner, for bringing this bill to our attention. This cleanup and appropriate language and excuse you to work on other things. Welcome to your intern. I'd like to see interns justify. I'm sure you might not be supposed to. This will also be a backup. Okay. We've got a second backup over here in case we need it. And we also, I'd like members to know, do have Jerry Anderson and Joe Sanderson online. And we, of course, both legislative ethics. And then we have Diana Priscilla, who is a certified nurse and midwife from Fairways. And I'm wondering if she might have been impacted by this disclosure or something like that. We'll hear from her after we make the presentation.
All right, well, good afternoon. I'm Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jesus Smith. I'm a legislative intern for Senator Gardner for discussion. I'm here to speak about SB 24. This bill has three sections, so I thought I'd start out to the afternoon by giving sort of an overview of the bill before diving into each specific section. As Senator Gardner mentioned, this is something we need to carry on behalf of the Legislative Ethics Committee. So last year, The problem that Bill seeks to address is that the office unions are always able to conduct trainings with each legal entity they have contracts with. Section 1 clarifies applicability of the ethical standards to legislative consultants, interns, contractors, and legislative volunteers. For example, I as an intern will still be required to comply with statutes banning things like disqualifications, banning use of other kinds of partial legal purposes, things of that nature. Section 2 clarifies how ethics requires ability of an legal entity. For example, if the FCMEDA contract with an independent contractor halfway through a session, ethics sessions would be invited only to those who would be working on the project with the legislature. Section 5 would not apply to those who work at the office of the legislature that is having a contract with, but who are not directly working on that project. If the PDA is the contractor, not all of their employees are held to abide by the ethical standards of the Alaska State Legislature. Section 3 defines legislative employees to include a person other than a legislator who is compensated by a legislative branch in return for providing regular or substantial services, regardless of pay scale, when status is full or part-time. It will not include interns, contractors, and the like, but that does not mean that contractors are exempt from ethical standards. That concerns addressed in the first section, which specifically states that interns, consultants, etc. are employees for purposes of compliance with ethics standards. As was mentioned by Jerry Anderson, the current ethics committee administrator Tom Line, as well as the previous ethics committee administrator Torres Anderson, that should mention in the record that they share the same last name are of the commission.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Sweet? Excellent job presenting. So no questions at this time. We'll go ahead and let you off the hot seat and go then to Jerry and Joyce. So, Mr. Anderson and Mrs. Joyce Anderson, whichever of you would care to go first, if you'd like to just at least, I know you've said a couple of other questions, but I think members would like to at least hear that you're supportive of the bill on the record. So, if you put yourselves on the record, each of you individually, and any remarks you want to make, but just get an email to support the legislative ethics task for.
This is Jerry Anderson. I'm the candidate for the Canadian Legislature, and I have been here in the office of the Canadian Legislature. Thank you.
The citizens of the United States cannot rely on the current Congress to enact this law. Our best chance of seeing this problem rectified is through Article 5 of the Constitution. Our Senate and Senate approves the knowledge of reaching the 34-state threshold, so this convention may be called, and a serious discussion of Taiwan's very health. This year, I think, is a step toward ending business as usual in Washington and resuming them to the needs of the people. With me today to provide more information as well as any answer to any questions you may have is Nick Fernandez from the U.S. Temples organization. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Welcome. Can you introduce your colleagues? For the record, I am Nick Fernandez with U.S. Temples. They're a national nonprofit organization dedicated to the advancement of term limits for members of Congress. And there was an 1995 Supreme Court case called USCO v. Thornton. We were actually the USCO in that case. We were the appellant. What happened was you had 23 states that we assisted to put term limits on their members of Congress through referendums, and the court, you know, throughout every single one of those laws, said that states would not have additional qualifications for office, not to authority in the Constitution. But they did, you know, they foreclosed on that, but they did got silver lining, which is you can do it through a constitutional amendment. And that's how we get to Article 5 right now. The way Article 5 works, just to summarize for the record, is 34 states need to pass resolutions calling for a convention on the same subject. At that point, the convention is required to be called by the Congress. All the delegates are appointed by the states, so the states are fully in control of the convention. They can propose an amendment for congressional term limits. Possibly more than one amendment doesn't have to propose any if it doesn't want to. And then it would get ratified by the legislatures for conventions within 38 states. And we absolutely support adoption of this resolution. I think, you know, Congress is geographically and practically removed from the people of the United States. I have a quote from a professor at UC Irvine, Mark Petraka. He said, "Congress is in stark contradiction to the central function of political representation in the Democratic Republic. They look to connect the people in government to representatives who share their values and stay in touch with the reality of their day-to-day lives." And, you know, as Forrest mentioned, Congress has 13% approval rating, but its incumbents still get reelected at 95%. So it really is a broken system. Districts are forced to emerge and gerrymander to allow for a real degree of accountability from the voters. And, you know, the staff you screen, and it's the special interests who step in and really are able to sway these congressional campaigns into members of office for, you know, decades at a time. At 700,000, the average U.S. House district is 4,000% larger than Alaska's state house district. So it's not, if you don't have one person to come in and limit or influence an election by using grassroots settings, as you can see here, it's really limited. There's another study by Chapman University that concluded that the U.S. House of Representatives actually has worse turnover than the House of Lords and of the Soviet Politburo, the Soviet Union. And so we want a great election system that's open to the best and brightest minds in the states, allow for fresh ideas to move up and change Washington. And we would really kind of rebalance our federal system so that the Congress is more accountable to the people, and it looks more like this is a legislature going to do that here. The convention process, like I said, would be within, you know, the state's purview. You'd be able to name them, you'd be able to give them instructions. If they don't do what you ask, you can actually recall them. And the amendment can be flexible. It just has to stay within the subject of term limits for members of the Congress. Delegates get to select how many years it would be, how the current incumbents would be treated, you know, whether they'd be grandfathered into the system, or whether the clock would start ticking at the time the amendment is ratified. And, you know, under the Alaska statutes, there already are term limits on your congressional delegation. That's in Title 15, Chapter 30,
but there's no fight by the Supreme Court. So maybe this is the right way to sort of echo the sentiments of the people and restore the citizen government that they had requested. The Article 5 procedure is a sort of custom design by the founders of the country for a moment like this. At the Philadelphia Convention in 1787, they were actually going to elect guest Congress for those titles, and then they were going to elect the states do it, but only with the approval of Congress. But then George Mason, as a delegate from Virginia, insisted that you would need a process that can bypass Congress in order to create a loose power from Congress. And that's how the Article 5 Convention was born. It was not intended to be any better than and then used like the states and the founders intended for us to actually go ahead and use it to rebalance this general equation. And there's never really been a better time to do it than right now. I think, as you mentioned, the debt and deficits are at record levels. Congress is not responsive to the people. And so we support adoption of this resolution.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Tomalovis. Any questions? Yes, Senator Guzman. Thank you. Welcome to Alaska.
Thank you. Great question.
Just quickly, how would this, if this were to pass and then there were to be a convention of states and then one of four imposed, how would that affect the balance of power between the three branches of government?
Three big branches of government at the federal level?
Yes.
Well, you right now have a president who's been term limited since 1951, and when you have a Congress that is always able to outlast the president, the rotation of office that you have at the executive level occurs on a regular basis, and the elections, especially the advantages for both sides, are pretty neutral. Whereas in Congress, you have very lopsided, almost perfunctory elections where members are just getting reelected over and over again with nominal opposition. And so I think what you would see is it really reinvigorate the Congress and it would more enable the will of the people to say, put a check on the executive branch if you really feel that their voices are being heard in congressional elections.
So the executive branch includes bureaucracy. So
the average time that the number of federal bureaucrats that we have in the executive branch and then the average number of years that they have served in those positions?
I
don't know offhand. I can definitely get that data for
you. Okay. Okay. So when you on this before going through state by state, you got to a critical mass and time to court. Who was the lead on the other side of the issue from you guys?
On the opposite side of the issue? It was a congressman, actually, the Arkansas man, Ray Thornton, who challenged their seat. Mark Brandon, some of them were statutes, some of them were state constitutional amendments. And I think he challenged the state constitutional amendment in Arkansas. And then the lower court there ruled in his favor, and we appealed to the Supreme Court, and we were shot down by a 5-4 decision. It was Justice Thomas who wrote the dissenting opinion in our favor. And Justice Scalia also was voted on our side. We're narrowly defeated.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting that the congressman would be the one that would kind of do that. And then probably the other question is, that congressman's distinction, you had how many states, 27, you said?
It was 23. At that point, Senator, it was almost half of the Congress was for a moment, as a matter of fact. And so at that point, it looked inevitable that the Congress was going to propose the amendment to the states using a two-thirds vote, because the members in term limit states did not want a situation where they were at disadvantage. And so, it looked like that was going to happen. Congress had, I think, 5 votes on it. They passed the majorities, not the supermajority that they needed. But then Thornton's position sort of and then all that discussion. And this is the path that we have before us now.
I'm very happy that I'm curious because some people, I think, are trying to top our senior senator, especially all three, but really has to be a lot of general capability. And so, at the convention level, should you move forward with this and we get the actual two-thirds for the necessary, but I guess this Congress really then does get attention to this thing. At that point, it would be a prospective, do you think, or in your anticipation, do you think it would be a prospective, or do you think it would start from the day that it became a conventional last year?
Well, I think that is something that we want the delegates to be able to decide, and we're sort of trusting in the wisdom of the states to make that call. From our own perspective as an organization, we tend to favor a prospective term limit. So the clock would start ticking, you know, when the amendment is ratified. We wouldn't want the current members to be exempted forever. But at the same time, we also wouldn't want them to be thrown out of office if they were elected, you know, under different circumstances.
That's why we need to clear up here, because at this point, I think there's our own congressional delegation who, without ourselves in multiple places, might feel that we're trying to face it on. I think that would be, at least from my perspective, as far away from the things as possible. But I think as a nation, if we can get consensus of us needs to the mayors, I think would be worth the effort. And so, and the other thing I noticed is, this is not the only continuous application that we have in the statute with regard to Title V or the subsection of Article 5. And so, have you had an experience at all with these continuous applications knocking, or do they dissipate automatically based on political wind?
Just a clarification. Senator, you're asking whether the application movements tend to dissipate after time if they're not getting enough traction.
I'm not sure if I'm right. I didn't have a testimony, but I wanted to have a dialogue. First of all, so we're not interested in keeping our Senate resolved. It would have to be something that we would have to have a very good discussion on nationwide. The other thing is, we are continuing this, and we've got our continuous application under the constitutional budget amendment. I think there's been way back in the 90s. But this is lost action. But in fact, my wife and I just come forward, I'm thinking, oh, what? The United States have already come forward. But it's an issue of my thing. I think right now there's about five different Article 5 issues moving forward. This would be one significant one.
When you look at the history of Article 5, particularly in the 20th century, there are two things that I'm sort of happy with. The first is that the movement will dissipate because there's not enough popular support. And that came from a lot of sort of regional issues. For example, in the 1960s and 70s, the southern states wanted to Article 5 convention to overturn some of the progressive Supreme Court decisions. They wanted to do an Article 5 for the busing situation down there in the civil rights movement. And they couldn't get 34 or they couldn't get 34 because those are not national issues. They don't really have national support. And so there are sort of regional issues that will die out. And then what you have is when you finally do latch onto a national issue, you see a situation in which the Congress will act before the convention can be convened. That's what happened in 1913 with the direct election of senators initiative. They were actually one city away from getting the convention. And then Congress went ahead and pushed the Senate, and the Senate, went along with it, and they finally got that amendment ratified. Constitutional term limits, the repeal of prohibition, so several of the amendments that are in the Constitution right now were not done by Article 5 convention, but they were pressured by Article 5 convention.
I don't want to bring up Brianna because it's been a rich history of America putting Congress under pressure, just like we have been here many times from our own governors. And I just didn't want to go up and see you at this point. So thank you.
I have a question and we'll go to Senator Costello. So, in the reasoning of the court in 1951 and then the later, how is it that the court in the, let's see here, the Confucius Garden, how did they distinguish between their reasoning in 1951 in the sense that the Constitution clearly set requirements for the presidency and for members of Congress, different needs requirements for those of Congress in the House and different for those in the Senate, as one example, different terms of office, and the theory being much higher than what the case, sorry, just to mistake on the record, but in Thornton was that fundamentally the ruling was that you couldn't go back retroactively and redefine what the qualifications would be for a term of office. How did they distinguish their opinion from the ruling in 1951 that allowed the presidency of the United States to then in fact be arguably redefined?
Madam Chair, the reasoning there was that because in 1951 it was the Congress initiating a constitutional amendment against the President's charter, in 1951 the Congress actually went and amended the Constitution to add the additional qualification that became the 32nd Amendment. But in 1995 there was a Supreme Court weighing in on state statutes and state constitutional amendments. So it didn't have the same force of law as the amendment for the president.
Understood. And so, caring for your story, where you had roughly 50% of Congress under term limits in 59, that would have arguably led to the 24th Amendment. It would have been pushed forward in the courtrooms, and that's fine. But it's the method by which it happened that's very interesting. So, apparently the work term limits is not in the process, the actual limits themselves would be determined at that point. So, just for the sake of argument, if you were to say that in the House of Representatives there were two term limits and also was a two term limit, how many? Can you tell me information? Because I'm sure you can find yourself complicated, but if those types of term limits existed, how many U.S. presidents would not have gone from a consecutive service to their country first by being in the House of Representatives and the Senate and then running for Congress? The assumption in my mind being that if there was a family, if they were termed out, then probably then it was likely to one, you know. Do you give me that information? Because what I'm thinking of here is it's an interesting balance between values. On one sense, you mentioned you want the process to be open to younger, wider people with new ideas, fresh ideas, and that perhaps that the advantage of the economy here is so great that we're not seeing a turnover yet. The research would indicate it should exist with how unhappy people are with the elected officials. On the other side, there was the balance of power where, judges are, they're life, and the bureaucracy of the executive branch is set up by the president, but the majority of the people in that branch are actually career bureaucrats. So there's we see this in Sudan too. It's the folks that have been there for three decades that know the departments, they know the history, and really, when you have, in a 4-year term, that's really not that long, 4 years, and, perhaps 8 years, perhaps more. So I'm curious, have you thought about weighing the opportunity cost that you're talking about here when you discuss term
Senator, we have looked at this question extensively. I don't have any data in front of me at the moment. I can certainly get back to you. But in our research, we found that in many cases, sometimes the newer members are actually more skeptical of the wasting power of the bureaucracy than those who have served for a very long time. And in fact, we had commissioned polling in the 1990s of Washington staff, bureaucrats, and lobbyists on the matter of term limits for the Congress, and they were all resoundingly opposed to it.
So, you know, we think preserving institutional knowledge is absolutely very important. There's no reason why when the delegates vote to write the term limit, they have to strike the right balance between, you know, fresh ideas while still allowing for experience. But I think in some cases, having pieces of the government structure that stick around, if not the legislators who are, you know, elected or the executive, having certain pieces stick around to provide institutional knowledge, that's something that the members can rely on, is not always a detrimental thing.
It's a fascinating discussion, no question about it, but you have the two sides, and in some ways, in 16 years, we're discussing, I'm just only discovering all the bodies of being able to sort of be a functioning it's important to me, as an example in Comover, in a way you don't know when it started, but suddenly you're able to find, and I'm not thinking about Jeff specifically, but he is an example in Comover. I mean, nobody would look at that and didn't want to think that that's a Comover idea. Somehow, you end up with Comover, and the concern would be the legislative Comover that can happen from time to time where people sort of lose track of why they're here and what that accountability is to the people. And it's an interview, so I want to make that clear on the record, but it can happen. And part of my reason for doing it is just so that it already happened to me. And so I feel that there are great arguments on both sides, and I'm ultimately more compelled by the idea that it's good to move people through. Particularly when you think about the generational disconnect that we now have in millennials with our government, I think there's another part of that kind of fiscal space we're having about how do you reconnect people to fundamental ideas. And I think when you talk to a young person, I also talk to big lectures, though, that there's not a lot of traction because it involves new ways of thinking that you can register. You have to be 30 days in advance, and you can be on your iPhone, whether it be VR bills and check our bank balances and other quite secure things. But when you talk to millennials and business, there's only one thing that there's any connection. And we're mindful of why we're just so mindful and go there and it's so better. So I think this is one of those interesting things to think about. So,
I think that's a kind of interesting discussion. This would force a question on people in America. For example, our voting turnout rate is very, very low right now. And, if we had a higher rate of turnover, you probably wouldn't get nervous. And if we had a higher rate of voter turnout, I would say, you probably wouldn't get nervous because right now we're probably way under 30% and not quite much over 11% in voting turnout. Of those qualified voters. In which case, at this point, virtual 70% of people back. The presidential election draws on more, if we got a lot. I noticed that 2 years, 2 years after the presidential, they got some, and they're still under 50%. So I get why we have to do this. We have to kind of go through and break a system that has found its comfort zone and low voter turnout with a continuous. You know, there were low voter turnout in Alaska. Our low voter turnout is in the primary federal, and in the federal election, probably much higher. So, I think then when you say people, okay, we're going to handle it and we have to do these things. However, I look at this as a power effect on a local level. My dad was a mayor of a small town for like 28 years. And it wasn't because it doesn't want to go off public service, and they wanted him to continue doing it. And so there was a 28-year run in our community that was a huge benefit to that community based on the leadership style they liked. And I hate to think that way as voters. Those are things that we have to think about as a voters.
Senator Stonewall said Dick Stevens, and we knew that. And one other conversation we did have in my office was the fact that in some ways the smaller Western states can be the beneficiary of that institutional knowledge continuum, because as an institution, a lot of federal employees are buried. And what your delegation does, arguably enough, in your power, is it particularly in the U.S. Senate, but when you're a small population like Wyoming or Alaska, and likely never going to get over that 1 million population threshold. But over the discussion, with your permission, Nicholas, I'll go to my parents and then to Lee Goodson, Kathy Diesel is in the room. And I think one of the individuals testifying in her law has a time commitment. So we will bring this back up in the year as well. And
Thank you.
alternative to using the foster care system. And it was trying to keep children out of the foster care system, and it would still meet parents' needs. So it allows parents to execute an power of attorney over their minor child for no more than 1 year, giving that power of attorney to another person, thereby preventing the child from having to be put into foster care at a time when parents are facing a particular challenge in their family. This allows parents and guardians who are struggling and need to seek help with unemployment, homelessness, addiction, or a multitude of other concerns to not have that concern of losing custody of their children or being held liable for abandonment, abuse, or neglect of that child while they resolve these family issues. So there are provisions in the law that also include military parents or guardians, as well as incarcerated parents, allowing them to confer this power of attorney to someone else, another healthy family, intact family, for that child's care. The bill does not require the person appointed as attorney, in fact, to comply with licensing requirements of a child care facility or foster care. So this is kind of an informal, if you will, and yet formal by the power of attorney piece of it. So thank you for sharing the bill that will help keep families together and keep children safe and help prevent abuse and neglect. I do have my very able staff person, Karen Cardinal, here, who can take you through the bill if you'd like, Madam Chair. Yes, I think what we'll do today is going to do so. I'd like to ask members if you wouldn't mind just allowing the folks that are here to testify have time to change. Let's bring them forward, and then we'll bring you guys back, and we'll get through as much of the bill as we can. And arguably, it's our custody here. Go first to the center side. A lot of people think about it and then bring it back up. So we'll get as far as we can today. We'll bring it back up this week. Okay. Thank you. And so, Anna Marie, please say your last name for me. Are you online? No, you're not. It's okay.
Okay.
Okay. So if you could just put your name on the record, then please, and go ahead and offer testimony on Senate Bill number 180.
Yes, my name is Anna Marie, I'm from Park. I'm from the Bill 180 because I was just in the program, and I'm from the Bill 180. So I'm in the Bill 180 and I don't know, I'm had like a many they had this amazing thing, and I don't want to everyone, you know, is to need to highlight them. Everyone is there because it's communicated on the phone. I really appreciate that this makes them come between quite near, you know. That's what I have to say right now.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? Okay, so next we'll go to Charity Carney, who's in Ohio. And next to her is Teresa Campbell with the Department of Health and Social Services to answer questions. Just to answer questions. So, just go ahead and raise your hand when you're on the heart. We recognize you as a SMS language. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Charity Carney, and I'm the founder and president of Beacon Hill, which is a foster care and adoption community resource center in downtown Anchorage and helps operate in the valley. We recently started a program called Safe Families for Children in Alaska. We're actually the 37th state to launch this international program. It's now in 7 different countries, and the UK is actually implementing it countrywide as a government funded program. But in other states, it's a privately funded program that is meant to basically keep kids out of going to foster care if at all possible. So these are families that are not in situations of abuse or neglect or maltreatment, but situations just like that we was talking about, where maybe there's a surgery, which is how I was seeing that yesterday, was a 20-month-old where the mom is dying of kidney failure and the dad needed to go find a job and was able to care for his 20-month-old for a little while, then destitute him in an RV. And so he called his son, probably after 3 months, of somebody to take my little girl. And a lot of the families we serve actually may have had OCS involvement in the past, and then they worked really hard to get the kids back, and then they knew that there was something happening where it might trigger some, you know, need for involvement right now. So we have a mom who called because she knew she was about to relapse again on heroin, and she called and said, I need you to come take my 2 5-month-old babies. And so that's what we intervene, and we just recruit healthy families around the community. We have about 15 different churches that are recruiting people. And you don't have to be a member of that church. You just have to be willing to kind of be a part of their support network. And they take in the children, these families take in the children. We use the student's background check system to make sure everything's clear. We want them to do not test it, so dance record, go back to set to home studies, just so you can be able to do it in the life of home. But then you take in the children with no compensation and to serve that family and help them. So that's what we're doing. And the bill actually is just because in other states what's happened is OCS, you know, remember the telemarketer program was in that state that said it was fine with them, safe families for children, but then regulations changed or leadership changed or something happened and somebody got a little bit nervous. And so we just don't want that to happen. We have a tremendous relationship with OCS, and they have given us a variance to operate safe families for children in the state, but it's a variance we have to renew annually. And I don't know that we're not going to do that, but because we are not actually doing foster care, we're just implementing and arranging parents to allow other parents to watch their kids. We would like to be exempt from having to be licensed as a child placement agency. And then we would also like our families that are doing the hosting not to ever have to be required to be actually licensed foster families. So that's the intent of the bill. There's some language in the bill that is a little bit vague in the sense that perhaps if we give a general exclusion for parents who give this release, that maybe somebody might misuse it to avoid investigation or something like that. So we're working on language to maybe tighten that down so parents can do that. And then the other thing that we're looking to tighten is that maybe the only people exempt from child placement agency licensing would be organizations like us who would be approved organizations under that law. Excellent. Well, we look forward to it just continuing, material improvements in the bill. Thank you for what you do. I mean, you had a different career and a former life, and it's wonderful. The whole concept of Beacon Hill is amazing, and I know a lot of people in my community that speak highly of it. And it reminds me of one point where I went to the Innovation Nursery, and that funding Proud Away, that same idea that parents that were caught young, new, addicted problems were able to take a time out and know that they didn't run the risk of permanently losing their child, and I think are addressing that in some with this. I really also just reminds me of the state survival bill that we also worked on here in previous iterations. That same idea that, you know, it's the kids that come first. So thank you for what you've done. Are there questions for Ms. Gordy? Okay, thank you. And so, I've got one other person that's in our case that wishes to testify other than the department on the record, and I'd like to bring you guys back up. And that person is Andrew Brown with the Foundation for Government Accountability. Andrew, are you wishing to testify as an ability?
Yes, I'm sure I am.
Excellent. Please put your name on the record and offer your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Waters, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Adrian Brown, and I serve as senior fellow for Child Welfare Reform for the Foundation for Government Accountability. We are a non-profit organization dedicated to growing our lives for individuals and families through improving health and welfare programs nationwide. There are nearly 3,000 children in unhealthy foster care in Alaska. In the last several years, the foster care population has been on an upward trajectory. Statistically, we know the majority of children in the foster care system, either because of neglect, not physical or sexual abuse. And because of these children have become a temporary crisis, like homelessness or medical emergency, as you have heard here, or stress in families, or more dealing with issues like poverty. These children don't have to be in foster care, but they are there because the system is overwhelmed, and most often they pass up more than children to get the treatment that they need. But I'd like to speak with you today as a co-chair of Hawaii and the innovative program called Safe Families for Children. As you heard, I'm working here in Alaska to address this problem. And in my child group, it's both primarily in the local community, to go alongside families in crisis before problems get to the point where those face intervention. I've spent my career on how welfare funders handle the importance and difficulty of the issues that you face. When I was still in law school, I had an opportunity to work with some children coming up in the child welfare system in the schools we live in Quebec. It was during this time that I spoke my first words in court. We're going to be doing this coming and always rights that are children. Not only is paying up next to me, but that is probably available on the court. Now, I still believe that this was the purpose leader who converted those children. I know this had an impact on me, because I underscored to me the fact that this was all those long-term kids. She didn't have the resources that she needed, or the network to turn to get life back on track. This day I still wonder how this person's life and the lives of children could have been different had she done the support that she needed before the war came to our control. A few years later, while I was working on the options of the hard and sweet things for children, while reaching out to charities was a very unique organization that mobilized the local community to actually come along alongside families in crisis before things got out of control. In the first part of this organization, I immediately thought this mother and her kids, and how this solution might have changed the lives of the daughter and the aunt. The process is simply simple. Namely, helping the individual talk to control. I'm sure you all have learned about explaining how sweet families work to recruit, screen, train, what they call host families. They volunteer to support families and take care of the care of the children, or when parents need the help that they need. Nationwide, the State Families Network is active in 27 different states. They've been around since 2002 and serve more than 20,000 children. Of these 20,000 children, 90% successfully return home within an average of 45 days and never in the child welfare system. Now, if you know anything about child welfare, this is an astounding statistic. A child who lives in foster care, there's roughly a 50-50 shot of never going home from the moment that they are in foster care. The average length of time that a child spends in 100 days. That's on average. So what we know statistically, and from more than 20,000 families that have health care state families, is that this is a program that is usually vulnerable. The affordable stimulus has to be involved in the game involved. And because of the legal ratings and the support section that provides, it allows families to actually heal and to remain intact at home, which is better for children's development than being in front of a family no matter what. As we have been inspired by the best practices that have been developed by other families over the last 14 years, we're going to try to find certainty for the continued use of this tool to give those families another tool that they can use for their own investigations. And most importantly, to protect the lives of parents. For me, as someone who voted for welfare, the most important piece of this legislation is the language that the parents are loving the choice to provide for the temporary care of their children when they work to get their life stable. Can't be held against by yourself. You understand that you have to be able to remain responsible. Can't be used to help the existing program time to review the correction of the data for their kids. That is a significant because of one of the biggest reasons why families suffer isolation is because they're afraid to ask for help. Now, I've spoken to a lot of families in crisis over the years, and one of the questions I always try to ask here, well, why didn't you go to the CS or the equivalent of your family? Well, and then they don't have a crazy person and say, those are the people that are taking my kids from me. Now, the irony there is if they don't get help, their kids are likely to be removed from them anyway. Safe Parents for Children in Refugee 180 removes that fear and inspires these families to ask for help. They don't have to get out of control. Thank you for your consideration of this important piece of legislation today. I think we have opportunities here to improve the lives of thousands of children across the country and in the state of Alaska. And I respectfully ask for your support and move to see any questions you may have.
Thank you so much, Mr. Brown. I've just been in a couple of those experiences in the hospital as well. They're just awful. And I am one that you've taken a personal experience in turning into something positive, so thank you for this one. The questions from Mr. Brown? Okay, hearing and seeing none, one of the questions jumped on the line. I'll defer to the sponsor if you'd like. It is Benjamin Miller with the City of Family for Children. Okay, so Mr. Miller, if you'd like to provide the material on the record and offer testimony, we're here.
This is a judiciary community ticket. Thank you, Madam Chair. There was going to be this very initial long time in Anchorage. And I'm part of the office of the Family and Youth Concerns for Children. We are actually able to have standards in the past those months for some of the immigrants. What I can say is we've actually been in the experience to get out in the young with us in the long haul and able to.
Just one question for you. One thing that I like in particular about this program to families for children is the fact that there isn't financial compensation. I think that again, not to cast aspersions at all foster parents, but we've had some cases in the house that have risen up to the front page that have been quite horrific, where it's clear that the motive for becoming a foster parent has been financial. And I just wanted to ask as a parent, I would assume and hope that the churches and the nonprofits gather and rally around you and other families with respect to need supplies, diapers, basic food supplies, etc. But I guess my question is, how supported do you feel from that angle? And is my observation correct that you know, in removing your financial incentive, that's a good thing? And maybe you'll be able to find
that's not a question. We are overwhelmed with the support that we have had years now, and we get the best of care. And then we receive tons of diapers and food and regular food, and the support of the community has been amazing. And I think the fact of not having that financial support for
as a designation of the power of attorney does not terminate parental rights or obligations of the parents or guardian over the minor child. However, it does not constitute abandonment, abuse, or neglect unless that parent fails to regain custody of that child following the expiration of the power of attorney. And on this point, I didn't hear my question very well earlier. So page 3, lines 18 through 21, included in the form, the very three exceptions on page 2, lines 4 through 7. And my only question there would be, I assume this to be true, but that nothing in this document would supersede rights that minor children have to judicial bypass laws of Minnesota website as it would stand. And that's my question for those who gave the issue of abortion, let's say 16 or 17 year old alleging a medical condition, I don't know what it would be. Or in the case of, I don't see it in the motion, but I think it's only in the case of abortion, but in the current laws being judicial bypass.
Is that a good classification? So, I think there's a significant classification of this government. So, I think you just need to think about I don't know that they really impact any of those, because you talk about the right of a power of attorney, not the right of a child of a parent. So, my guess is that's the case, but those are things that we should have.
So, what I mean by that, so, is that in those individual cases, is on line 17, but if you read that whole section, I delegate powers, including the right to, and there's medical treatment, dental treatment, and other activities. So,
yeah,
it is a good tool.
I see that. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Any
other questions? This is Marcella.
Thank you. My question is about, it's on page 2, the power of attorney. I'm curious, in the case where we have two parents, one had a sentence form that actually underscore, underline the rights of the other parents. I see that. I'm just curious about this, but I also, we're looking at other power of attorney bills in this committee. So I just want to make sure that we're not doing something that hasn't formally been looked at in terms of anything that comes from it.
And so just to clarify on the record, Senator Diesel, that bill is House Bill 8 by Representative Sean Hughes, and so that would be a big thing between now and next week. Have your team get together with others. I know about Senator Diesel has got a keen interest in that. It's a bill that would mostly comport with the sort of national standard updating the laws on powers of attorney, but there are some additional changes that Representative Hughes has proposed that are before the committee for consideration, so that'd be a good conversation to have. Senator, we'll ask you.
I'm afraid we have about 30 seconds left. I just have some legal questions about how this all going to work, and you need to just kind of hurry up and get back to the back. So, because first of all, is can we do this now? Is the work on the internet? Is it data? It's going to go from here, but I don't know. So I guess I'm curious about that. Second is ability to sue. If there's medical costs that occur, mental costs that occur, so does the person who's got power to have a debt to collect from the other parent? So just give us all how it would all work. These differences, could you say a 15-year-old co-host and stays with an 8-year-old and a 17-year-old that's anticipated to. And then just other questions like right to collect the PFD, for example. Is the charge of the PFD, does that go to the biological parents or to the parents?
Thank you. I appreciate this question, Mr. Chair. Senator Murkowski, actually, I believe Ms. Hines can probably answer them, but I know where I've started today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's both of you for your patience in this community. Also, and please be aware that we're happy to take your testimony and answers online. And it's an extended time, but I know it's very cost-friendly, unfortunately, to access your safe capital. But we look forward to working with you and resolving these questions as we move forward. I just commend you for the bill. It's innovative. It's an out-of-the-box approach to thinking about something that really bothers all of us. And I just really appreciate you putting it forward. And I'm confident that with some work, we can answer these questions and get the policy moving forward. So appreciate everyone for being here today. And with that, we're adjourned.